I want you to imagine that you're sitting against a cool stone wall, and you're surrounded by stone floors, and high above your head in the deep, calm shadows, you sense the soaring roof of this Benedictine monastery in northern Scotland. It's 4:30 in the morning, and there is only the gentle light of dozens of candles and the sound of the choir in the sanctuary. You can't actually see the monks who are singing, only hear their beautiful voices. These stone walls that surround you have absorbed the sung prayers 8 times a day for over 800 years. These are fortunate stones. Perhaps you can even imagine, as I did, that these thick stone walls have been changed by the vibration of those human voices. I imagine that the music of the monks, perhaps even what we just heard by the choir, Ubi Caritas, was heard by those stones. And as we all know, everything around us is vibration. Nothing is really as solid as it appears to our eyes. And that at the atomic level, the atoms are moving and being moved by forces in and around them. So it's not such an outlandish idea to imagine that those stones were vibrating at the frequency of those music, those prayers, sung prayers. Now, spiritual practice implies that there is something practiced on a regular basis, and that because it is practiced regularly, it influences the practitioner's experience of the world. As I imagine the effect of the musical notes on the stones of the monastery, so our bodies, our hearts, and our minds are influenced by what we do each day. I drove into a takeout at the White Spot recently to pick up dinner and was surprised to see a gentleman at the side of the building, obviously an employee on a break, kneeling on his prayer mat. He was practicing his Muslim faith by praying facing Mecca, the holy city. As a Muslim, he would need to find a place wherever he was 7 times a day to pray. When I lived in Toronto many years ago, I would wake up each morning and look out my bedroom window and see across the street a Chinese Buddhist family's grandmother who would come out on the porch every morning with her smoking incense and her fresh oranges to welcome and invite the gods to her home so that they would bring health, happiness, and prosperity to her family. I myself have a spiritual practice of walking in the woods each morning. I find that when I commit to doing it regularly, I experience a shift in my focus. The focus changes as I first make an intentional connection to nature, and secondly, a connection to the cosmos. Both are about establishing a relationship between the natural world, the trees in the park, and the universe, the firmament above my head, and me. And when I do this, the rest of the day and all the things I do, the places I go, the people that I hang out with, are supported by that first relationship established with the trees and the sky. Now, this pattern of behavior sustains me. It feeds my body and my heart and establishes a reality that is right for me. I hope that at this moment you might be thinking about the practices in your life that sustain you. I imagine, perhaps for Charlene and David, that music is something that sustains you. Raising a family can be a spiritual practice as we bring our best to the work of guiding, feeding, and supporting our children. Gardening, knitting, preparing and drinking tea, they can all be spiritual practices. My point is that there are many things that we do that can be spiritual practice, when we bring our intention and our attention to that practice. Spiritual practice is not confined to monasteries or incense or any particular physical postures. Practiced over time, to have a spiritual practice supports us, especially when we are faced with challenges. Analogy might be for a gardener who spends time each season building up their earth with compost and mulch to support the growth of the plants. And if done consistently, the dirt will support the growth of the flowers and the vegetables even if a season is missed. Now, living sustainably means to live within our means and implies an awareness of the future. To live economically and environmentally sustainable lives would then mean that we are living within our means, and our means includes the future. And here's this challenge. We are currently living in an unsustainable world, and our earth cannot sustain the requirements of our population in the style and size that we have or are projected to have. The consequences of our current industrial world and the requirements of the world population is that we are depleting the usable water, earth, and air. We are living beyond our means globally. We are also altering our global environment. So how do we respond to this reality or this information? Now, someone said, and excuse me, I can't remember who, but said that human beings cannot take very much reality. I thought so. Thank you. Well, I disagree. I think we require reality for our mental health, our survival, and our integrity. But we can and do get overwhelmed by reality sometimes, certainly by the scientific facts that are available to us at this point about the state of the earth. I know I do. It scares me. That is part of my reality. To know what is happening in the world and to be conscious and engaged in the reality of our time means that we need to be able to respond to our emotional and our psychological reactions. On my walk yesterday morning, it was very foggy, as it's been for weeks now, it seems. And that meant that the trees and the bushes were heavy with beads of moisture. And so, too, were the spider webs. Have you noticed the spider webs this fall? Extraordinary. They are everywhere made visible by the droplets of moisture. Magnificent architectural structures, delicate and strong, flexible and resilient. Yesterday, I was amazed again at the ability of the spiders to spin these long strands from across the sidewalk, apparently not attached to anything other than... How do they do that? a miracle that I don't know about. I have one spider web that has been in front of my house now for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I've watched this spider daily. When something touches his web, the whole structure vibrates and he responds. Climbing along the strands to investigate. Is it something good to eat? If it is, then he wraps it all up and at his leisure consumes it. If the disturbance has destroyed a portion of his web, he rebuilds. Now, I don't imagine he feels necessarily fear at the destruction of his web, so there might be a weakness in my analogy. But there is responsiveness. As the spider diligently, continually rebuilds his home, so do we need to respond to the reality that we're in our world. We need to respond to those facts and the fears in order to sustain ourselves and our communities. Now, part of the fear comes from simply how huge the problem of climate change is. It's worldwide. It's been growing since the beginning of the industrial age. And not a single one of us can stop it all by ourselves. We really are, at a level of reality, powerless. And that is overwhelming and scary. When I get overwhelmed and feel helpless and powerless, and perhaps you too, I can give up, I can turn off, tune out, which is not, I don't think, unreasonable response to a huge problem. But remember that spider. He responds as he can. And we have the power to respond as we can in the choices that we make, however small or large those choices might be. Every moment of every day, we have the power to make choices that move us towards greater sustainability. And each choice matters. Turning off the water, off the lights, the heat down, walking versus driving, keeping sustainability in mind when we're shopping, perhaps buying local seasonal produce, supporting small business, supporting the work of others who are doing what they can to make this world sustainable. It all matters. And doing something addresses the fear. That fear is just our survival response. It motivates action. But we cannot always live in fear. It is not sustainable. Our bodies and hearts and minds will become depleted by the chemicals that flood our beings when we are in that survival mode. So constant fear is an unsustainable reality. So what do we do then to live sustainably? Now, I know Carl Perrin was here just last week, but I'm thinking of the service that he did last year where he came and he talked about his answer to that dilemma. For those who don't know Carl, he is one of the people I know who is 125% committed to social activism around the environment and in particular climate change. And his solution to his dilemma, his fear, was to cultivate a spiritual practice of gratitude. And he talked to us about gratitude. Carl intentionally and with awareness shifts his reality from fear to gratitude, thereby sustaining his social activism into the future. I was reading a story in a book called The Soul of Money by Lynn Twist, and she describes the stock market crash of 1987 and how she and her husband lost a huge amount of money in a matter of hours. And then they watched hours and hours of television that reinforced their anxiety and their despair. But they did something different. They noticed what was happening to them. And they shifted from talking about what they had lost to talking about what they had. They shifted their focus to the wealth of love and health and happiness that they had in their family and in their community. And then they broadened that conversation and spoke with their friends who are also calling them in anxiety and despair. And after listening to the anxiety and despair, they introduced a shift in perspective. What do you put your value on? What sustains you? Is it the money that really sustains you? Or is there something perhaps deeper? So we have the power to respond to our world web by shifting how we perceive it. When I was thinking about this service and about environmental sustainability, I asked myself, how do we end up? How did we end up in this unsustainable situation? From a spiritual point of view, I'd say that we ended up in this unsustainable situation because of our dualistic thinking. Dual means two. So we have broken our reality into two pieces. There is this or that, you or me, my way or your way, the right way or the wrong way, the subjective and the objective, humans or the earth. And so we've cleaved ourselves from the earth with this type of thinking. So you see, there's a tree, and there's a person standing beside the tree. We see these two biological organisms as separate from each other. And, oh, you say, but they are. They are different, and they are separate. Look, there's a space between them. One's taller and has leaves, and one has feet and shoes, not roots. How can you say that they're the same? Well, yes, that's true. They appear to be different. But if you remember what I described earlier, the effect of sound vibrations on the stones of the monastery, what we see is not the whole of reality. When we look at the tree and the person who stands beside it, to get out of that dualistic thinking that defines what is different and thus separates one thing from another, we need to shift to the eyes that see holistically, a holistic reality, which is also true. When we do see then what we see is an interdependent system of lungs, a system of breathing. The tree breathes the person's breath. The person's breath is breathed by the tree. They are one breathing environment. How would our world be different if we all shifted to this holistic perception? We'd stop objectifying the earth. We'd see the irreality of interdependence. We'd perhaps change our language from me and it to us and ours. I see this as a spiritual challenge, as a challenge to transform ourselves and bring ourselves back into right relationship with the wholeness of the world. A sustainable long-range spiritual practice is to challenge ourselves to see the world and ourselves as this one entity. So how can we do that practically, every day, as a practice? Well, try this sometime. As you're walking down the street, intentionally only look at organic life. The trees, the weeds, the bushes, organic life. Don't let yourself look at the cars, the roads, the buildings. Okay? And notice what happens to your reality. Your environment and how you perceive it and your relationship to it will shift and change. Another thing you can do is notice your language. When you have that dualistic language, the me and it language, shift it to us. When you find that you're stuck between only two choices, change the or to an and. This and that. And then maybe that opens up a third or a fourth choice. These are small things, perhaps, but they can contribute to profound changes in how you think and live in the world. I'd like to try something with you now as we come to the end of this service. Earlier, the choir sang the meditation on breathing. I'd like us to sing that all together in your hymnal, 1009, I believe. But we're going to shift the words. And the words that I'm suggesting are in your order of service. They're, when I breathe in you. When I breathe out you. And if you want, you could use your imagination as you sing. And imagine singing this to a tree or the person sitting next to you. When I breathe in you. When I breathe out you. Let us stand as we are willing and able. Take a deep breath and sing together this meditation on breathing. And we'll just sing it through 3 or 4 times, David, okay? Not in rounds, just the simple words that are there. Choir, step down from complexity. And we'll just sing that one line. Okay? Here we go.
I breathe in you.
You and please take that with you into the world. Our closing words come from Arthur Waskow. He says, "In the beginning, the darkness covered the face of the deep, and then the rushing breath of life hovered over the waters. Let us breathe together. Let us catch our breaths from the need to make or to do. Let us be conscious of the breath of life. We breathe in what the trees breathe out. We breathe out what the trees breathe in. Together we breathe each other into life. Blessed is the one within the many. Blessed are the many who make one." So be it.